The Department of Child Safety is more transparent, but some state lawmakers still aren't satisfied. Could all this be solved with more money?
Unless you're specifically involved in this issue and really looking at it on a daily basis, the response you might get is, gee, I thought we fixed that. I think we're going to have to really make the case for more funding.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the Clean Elections Commission decides to pass on regulating dark money groups for now. A powerful lobbying organization has a new leader.
And a Gilbert community celebrates a birthday.
And so we want to do kind of this mashup of the best of suburbia, agrarianism, and urbanism all on the same project, so you get the benefits of each.
Plus, the gangs of Phoenix and what stinks near a Phoenix RV park.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. The Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission this morning took up the issue once again of regulating so-called dark money groups. In the end, the commission did not vote on a proposed rule change. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services joins me to talk about what it actually did do. Hi, Howie.
Good afternoon.
So what did the commission ultimately do?
Well, they took testimony and they listened to folks who had some concerns. Some of these were technical in terms of how do you define a dark money group as opposed to a quote-unquote social welfare group? And then, of course, Secretary of State Michelle Reagan got up there and said, I am the chief elections official. Only I get to regulate dark money. Never mind, I haven't done it. But the commission lacks the power and essentially said, if you go ahead and adopt this rule, count on seeing my lawyers in court.
Was there a sense that the commission could do anything in this realm that would prevent a lawsuit from the Secretary of State's office?
I think pretty much anything that they would do would lead to a lawsuit. I think it comes down to the belief by Secretary Reagan that only she gets to regulate independent expenditures, which is really what we're talking about here. We're talking about groups that spend money not in coordination with a candidate, taking TV ads saying, you know, so-and-so is great, or did you know that so-and-so kills babies? And right now, they do have to report they've spent money. And sometimes they're very innocent-sounding groups like Americans for a Better America kind of thing. And the problem is you don't know where the money is coming from. The problem becomes that they say, well, we're social welfare groups, and because we're not spending more than half of our money on influencing elections, we don't have to disclose the source. What the commission is proposing is to say, once a group spends at least $500 on an election, it's presumed to be subject to disclosure laws. And then it would be up to the group to convince the commission by, quote unquote, clear and convincing evidence, the law doesn't apply to it. That obviously has caused some concerns by many of the business groups, and obviously from Secretary Reagan, who says, you don't have the right to do that at all.
Is what the commission did today basically punt the issue to another time?
They did, because there were some substantive comments submitted. Some of the attorneys said, look, if you're going to do this, we're not conceding you have the power, you really should change it so that the burden would have to be on the commission to prove that a group is a dark money group trying to influence an election, rather than the group having to prove it's not. So they want to give some more time for public input. And what they're going to do is they're going to bring it back. At this point, looks like 60 days. And they will have various iterations of the proposal before them. And then they can decide, do they in fact want to go forward? My gut feeling at this point from listening to the commissioners is they do not believe Michelle Reagan, that they don't have the power, and that they will adopt something.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you so much, as always.
Glad to be here.
Division of Child Safety Director Greg McKay earlier this month revealed the agency would have a new strategic plan for addressing some serious problems. And on Wednesday, McKay spoke to the Child Safety Oversight Committee to give members an update, including on proposed rules that he says would give the agency some flexibility to close cases that are old or don't merit a full investigation. State Representative Kate Brophy McGee is co-chair of the Oversight Committee and joins me now. Representative Brophy McGee, what was the hearing's tone like?
Well, I thought the tone was very constructive. The qualifications of the committee are exceptional. Everyone has a very strong background in child welfare. I thought Director McKay was extremely frank, candid, you know, about the problems that the agency is facing. He was very receptive to suggestions and questions. I thought the meeting went extremely well. When you think especially about the lack of transparency that has plagued this agency in the past.
He has introduced a new strategic plan going forward. And one person I spoke to recently was Dana Namark of Children's Action Alliance, who's, of course, heavily involved in this issue.
Yes.
And she was very encouraged. She said, first, that there was a strategic plan. She thinks that he should be more transparent about saying that he needs more funds. And yesterday he seemed to indicate that that wouldn't solve the problem. But would it help, do you think?
I think that I understand what she's saying, but I don't think he is in a position to do that. As, you know, his boss is the governor of the state of Arizona, and the governor determines the executive budget. The agencies prepare their budgets. They submit them. I know that Director McKay is committed to prevention and early intervention services and sees the value of those. I think it's really up to the legislature to have that fight and get it done, because Dana is right. We can't turn this agency around, no matter how great the plan is, if we can't back it up with the resources.
Do you get a feel that lawmakers are supportive, or the lawmakers are a little tired at this point of that agency asking for more money?
I think that there is a certain component, given the depth and breadth of issues that we deal with, that might be in a classroom identified as ADHD. Unless you're specifically involved in this issue up to your elbows and really looking at it on a daily basis, the response you might get is, gee, I thought we fixed that. We put in a lot of extra money. We have given emergency funding to the agency over the past 2 or 3 years. We took about $9 million, $11 million back this past year. So I think we're going to have to really make the case for more funding.
If you could boil it down to a couple of top priorities, maybe one is short-term, maybe one is long-term, that you'd like to see DCS take on, what would it be?
Staff retention is huge, and stability. This agency needs stability in leadership. It's gone through a change in administrations. It's gone through a very rough change in directors. And so I think the employees, in order to understand where they're going, need that stability. You have to back them up with the resources to lower their caseloads, improve their training, and make sure that their supervisors have the backing and the support they need to help those frontline workers.
State Representative Kate Brophy McGee is co-chair of the Child Safety Oversight Committee. Always appreciate the chance to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
The group Greater Phoenix Leadership is made up of some of the biggest companies and most well-known people in the Valley. The group has announced its new president and CEO. Former Tempe Mayor Neil Giuliano will take over the position in November. And Neil, what makes you the right person for this job?
Well, I think, you know, it's a unique situation. I'm both someone who has a strong history and connection to the region, but I have been traveling for work for the last 10 years, and so I'm not super engaged with any of the dominant coalitions of what's currently taking place in the region. So I have the benefit of having a strong insider knowledge, but yet also can approach things with a very new set of eyes and a fresh set of ears to listen and learn about the challenges that the region is facing.
In your mind, what are some of the biggest challenges for this region that you'll be having to work with?
Well, we obviously have the ongoing issues of our infrastructure and transportation and everything that's related to transportation, which then drives economic development, which drives where people may be living, which drives the quality of our schools, which drives the strength of our community infrastructure on a very local basis. So everything is all related, and the concept that you can deal with transportation separately from education and separately from all of the other issues I think is a bad frame. We really need to be looking at things from a holistic standpoint for the region and ensuring that we're not having siloed conversations about particular issues because they're all connected. And when you advance something with one, you're going to impact the others.
Are there ways of trying to go about tackling those challenges and some of those problems that leaders maybe haven't thought about before? Because most of them aren't terribly new issues. They've sort of been lingering on for a little while.
No, I think the one thing that I've learned, and I think that we know, is that there's no one thing. Complex issues are going to require a complex understanding the data, looking at the evidence, being honest and open about the evidence, and then saying, okay, what can we do about this? What can we do about this in the very imperative short term? And what can we do about this in the important long term as well? And I think that frame helps because it takes a bit of the pressure off to do something really, really quick just for the sake of doing something and can allow you to be much more holistic and much more focused on long-term sustainability for the solutions that we want to put in place. You know, I think of things like the Rio Salado in Tempe, which is now, you know, coming up on 20-some years that we first started talking about doing the whole project and will their development ever come and will it become a place for families and people and visitors to enjoy? And it has, but it was a very long-term project and a very long-term vision. And I think it's okay to have that kind of an approach to things, yet being focused on if you have an imperative that needs attention right away, you have to address it.
What is your vision of where Phoenix should be and where this region should be nationally?
Well, Phoenix is clearly emerging as a global city. When you look at everything that's being done in the biosciences and biodesign, when you look at the tech industry, when you look at the presence of Arizona State University in partnership with other institutions and other organizations within the broader community, we have to harness that, and we have to have an approach toward building on that that is sustainable and that meets the needs of a growing population. So I think charting all of that out and looking where the opportunities are and looking where the challenges are going to be is going to be one of the first things I need to learn about.
Neil Giuliano, the former mayor of Tempe, the incoming president and CEO of Greater Phoenix Leadership. Neil, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Earlier this month, federal authorities arrested 180 suspected Arizona gang members. The U.S. Marshals Service says the suspects included fugitives wanted on a number of felony crimes, including homicide and robbery. Officials say Operation Grit 2015 also resulted in 189 cleared warrants and 34 firearm seizures. The Valley doesn't have the reputation for gang activity that other large U.S. cities have, but it's there. Scott Decker, Foundation Professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU, explains why gangs in Los Angeles and Chicago play a more prominent role.
Well, one is history. It's not been around as long. L.A. and Chicago can trace their gang roots in Chicago at least 140 years. In L.A., every bit of 80 or 90 years back. It also has something to do with the size of the area. We're big, but we're not nearly as big as L.A. We're not nearly as big as Chicago. One of the things that fuels gang membership and activity in Chicago is the presence of pretty well-defined and well-understood neighborhoods. That's true, albeit to a lesser extent, in Los Angeles, but still more so than is the case in Phoenix. What we have in common in Phoenix with those places that have large numbers of gang members, gang crime, and have had them for a long time is concentrated poverty, is a segmented job market, labor market that restricts access, and is a series of battles, if you will, between groups that are in neighborhoods struggling with each other for reputation and recognition, or that are pitched in battles between teens and young people that largely exist on symbolic grounds.
Mm. Earlier this month, there was attention given to a major effort by law enforcement in this area to arrest certain gang members, to crack down on them. You know, the skeptic would say, well, that's a terrific accomplishment, and yet aren't there going to be sort of other people just to replace those people? Are there certain methods that are working, or at least to limit the damage of gangs here?
The Justice Department estimates that there's somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 gang members on the street in the state of Arizona. That doesn't count the numbers who are in prisons and in prison gangs. And so if you take 100, 200, 300 of them off the street, unless you're very selectively taking off only the most established and important leaders, there isn't much effect from such things. Decades of very solid research and practice shows that the effective way is not one strategy, but the effective way to deal with gangs is multiple strategies. There's lots of evidence, and some of it comes from Los Angeles, that arrest and suppression-only strategies tend to make the gang problem worse unless they're coupled with prevention that keeps young kids out of gangs at earlier ages, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and intervention with either recent gang joiners or guys and women who haven't been in for quite as long, that if you don't have prevention, intervention to go along with the suppression, the arrest, the prosecution, and reentry, you're not going to be successful and you run the risk of perhaps making things worse.
Are there numbers to indicate what percentage of crimes, what percentage of arrests are related to gang members?
Gang members are heavily involved in violence, and they're more highly represented in violent crimes. That said, there are about 750,000, 800,000 gang members in the United States, according to law enforcement estimates, and that group by no means accounts for the majority or even as high as 20% of all serious crimes.
Scott Decker is Foundation Professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. Scott, thanks for the time.
Great. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is Heather. We're at Grand Canyon University during our third day of Welcome Week. We are currently moving in returning residents to all of their homes for the next year.
Okay, where are we going?
28, right or left?
Cars pull up and we unload their entire car, take it up the stairs, take it up the elevator, unload the room for them, and then do it all over again.
Yeah, I got it.
You know, some of the parents are honking everywhere and the kids are super embarrassed, and that's really funny to see, but I can see why it's overwhelming. I remember my freshman year coming in, everyone just swarmed my car, and before I was even out of my car, everything was gone. And at first I kind of like freaked out. I was like, oh my gosh, where's all my stuff? But it almost just gives you a sense of community like right off the bat. You know that you're really doing something great for them, and they know that they're coming in where they're welcome.
That was Heather Hartman helping with move-in day at Grand Canyon University. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should go back to school, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, focusing on learning through play that supports early childhood education and school readiness. Information at childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed at its lowest level since the start of the year, tumbling 358 points today. That's about a 2% loss. Analysts say investors are worried that a slowdown in the growth of China's economy may signal slower global growth. Cal State University economist Sungwon Song.
Chinese economy is slowing more rapidly than many people anticipated. Government wanted economic growth rate in the range of about 7%. It looks like it might actually fall below 7%, which is a serious problem for China.
And Son says for the U.S. as well, because China's problems are creating more volatility on Wall Street. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has resigned and is calling for new elections in a move aimed at winning support for his handling of the country's latest bailout plan with European creditors. John Siropoulos reports it was just 7 months ago that Tsipras rose to power.
Alexis Tsipras says he has exhausted the limits of January's popular mandate. mandate. He is asking the Greek people to renew it if they judge that the bailout loan he got from the country's creditors last month, on condition that he implement strict austerity measures, is in the country's interests. Recent opinion polls show his left-wing Syriza party enjoying double the approval rates of the opposition conservatives he unseated. This despite Syriza's about-turn from its election promise to stop austerity. Syriza came to power with 36% of the vote and rules with a coalition partner. The most auspicious polls suggest it could now win re-election with broad enough support to rule alone. For NPR News, I'm John Saropoulos in Athens.
President Obama says he and First Lady Michelle Obama are praying for former President Jimmy Carter as he undergoes radiation treatment for four small spots of melanoma on his brain. Carter says the cancer, which was first discovered in his liver, was recently detected on his brain. This is NPR News from Washington.
KJZZ is supported by First Guarantee Financial, a locally owned financial services company offering retirement income options designed to provide peace of mind against the uncertainties of market volatility. FirstGuaranteeFinancial.com.
This year marks the 15th anniversary for the Gilbert development called Agritopia. The community at Higley and Ray Roads and the Santan Freeway is made up of more than 400 housing lots, walking paths, assisted living, and as the name suggests, a farm. Joe Johnson is the man behind Agritopia. His business card says visionary, although he says that just means he has ideas and tries to make them happen.
The seed of the idea was basically I wanted to have a restaurant in our house that served produce from the farm, and that is Joe's Farm Grill today. But I started thinking, okay, well, if I had this restaurant, it would be nice to live close by it. And then that starts the whole idea of, like, where do you want to live? What do you want your community to be like? And very few people have a clean sheet of paper to design their own community. And so I started thinking about, what is it we want to do? We want to preserve the heritage of the farm, but we also want to create this really cool, vibrant village community, and hence Agritopia.
15 years later, has the reality of what you see when you wake up every morning matched sort of what you thought it would be?
I would say in general it's better, because in your mind, normally that first creation in your mind, the visualization, is usually better than the embodiment of it. In this case, actually living it and understanding the networking of people, the closeness, the walkability, living it, it's a lot richer even than you would think.
Besides your family, who lives in Agritopia? What kinds of people tend to be drawn to that?
There are a broad range of people, and what people are looking for that go to Agritopia would be, we want to know our neighbors, we want to be a part of community, we are not looking for isolation, we are not looking for a home as the be-all and end-all, but we are a part of a community.
What is left to do there? I understand that there's still some build-out left to happen there, right?
Sure. So Agritopia is basically, from my point of view, a 20-year project. So we're 15 years into it. This next five is going to be crazy, because we are actually doing two major projects. One of them is we've been doing adaptive reuse of all the buildings that were in the homestead. The last building is an 8,000-square-foot Quonset hut. So we are going to do a craftsman community in there. Then Agritopia Epicenter is the kind of the downtown. So it's going to have retail and food all on the bottom, and health-oriented things on the bottom of four buildings that also have three stories of apartments on top of them. And so we want to do kind of this mashup of the best of suburbia, agrarianism, and urbanism all on the same project, so you get the benefits of each.
Where do you see your community fitting in with other sort of master planned communities across the valley? Where do you think yours fits in?
Well, first of all, ours is tiny. It's only 160 acres. It's not a master planned community in the traditional sense of, you know, square miles of land. And so we do want to create in the town of Gilbert a nationally known village that shows what suburban development can look like, that suburbia does not have to be a carpet of sameness and of isolation, but that it can be this new pattern of development that kind of blurs rural agrarianism, suburbia, and urbanism all together. And so I see it as like a test model, a visionary village that I hope will take off around the country.
Do you expect this kind of development to catch on elsewhere around the valley?
I am hopeful. And I'm hopeful that realistically that the development community will, instead of trying to sell a product like a house or a clubhouse or this or that, be trying to create a community. And ultimately, that is a very profitable thing as well, but it's a different mindset. Are we selling a product, or are we trying to create community?
Joe Johnston is a self-described visionary and the person behind the Gilbert community of Agritopia. So will this kind of concept catch on? To find out, we call on Emily Tallon. She's a professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning at ASU. And Emily, is there a demand for this kind of community?
Oh, I think there's a tremendous demand because it's not your typical suburban sprawl kind of subdivision. And I think it's well documented now, especially in the last 5-10 years, that people are still looking for living environments that have some kind of sense of community, are paying attention to public space. Certainly there's a huge demand for walkable urban neighborhoods, and Agritopia is not so much on the urban end of the scale, but it does stress walkability and pays attention to that public realm that is definitely important to people.
Do developments like Agritopia, which is in Gilbert, face new competition now from homes or other communities in more urban environments that maybe they didn't have to deal with, 10, 15 years ago?
Yes, I think that might be true, especially since a lot of people are looking for lifestyles that don't involve having to have a car. And I don't know that you can live in Agritopia without a car. And certainly communities that are linked to public transit, that's an important factor to a lot of people. So it's still not a majority of the population looking for that urban lifestyle, but I think that the demand for that has increased.
Do you get the sense that developers in the Valley are looking at a project like Agritopia and thinking, we should do more of that? We should have these smaller communities that are either focused on a theme or maybe not, but have them, different colored houses and not everything looking the same, not everything brown, that kind of thing?
Oh, boy, I wish that were the case. I know that there is huge demand for those transit-oriented development locations, the walkable urban neighborhoods near the transit line, but having just a better designed community like an Agritopia, I wish there was a lot more interest on the part of developers, and I haven't seen a groundswell of interest in it.
Is that just because there's not enough demand on the part of homebuyers?
Well, that's what a lot of conventional developers will say, but I think it's a matter of education. I think that a lot of people are simply they don't know what alternative living environments might be like. So that's why a place like Agritopia is so important as a way of showing what the alternatives are, as having a model of, that's right there in physical concrete form that people can see. This is the kind of alternative life you could have that's way more enriching than your typical suburban sprawl kind of development.
Well, then what has to happen to get developers on board with that? I mean, what changes from here's this project in Gilbert that developers can look at to developers saying, hey, maybe we should try something like it?
Well, there's sticks and there's carrots. I mean, one thing, as a public policy matter, you would hopefully have a planning environment where such developments would be incentivized. The other realm, though, which is from the different direction, is to really get the word out and get the education out there to developers that there's money to be made. This is not about trying to convince developers they need to do the right thing because it's better for sustainability or whatever. I mean, there is money to be made, and there are developers who are understanding this, and it might take a little bit different of a bottom line kind of way of calculating costs and benefits.
Emily Tallon is a professor in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning at ASU.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, working to benefit the community, including those who rarely use public transit, by creating sustainable jobs through further development of the transportation system. ValleyMetro.org/connected.
A group of North Phoenix RV park residents say their health and welfare is in danger after a recycling plant opened up nearby.
KJZZ's Phil Latsman went out to investigate the odor that has One Valley neighborhood in a big stink.
Sandra Brin is the park manager at the Desert's Edge RV in the Deer Valley section of Phoenix. It's been here for 40 years. The thermometer says it's 105 degrees. But that's not what's most noticeable outside in the parking lot.
It's spicy. It kind of burns in your nose. It's not a trash smell. It's a composting smell.
Whatever it is, the stench seems to be coming from the general direction of the recycling plant down the street. Peering over the fence, there are several piles of trees and brush being composted into mulch. No waste products or garbage are evident, but ooh, that smell. Back at the RV park a block away, one of the residents is already waiting for me.
My question is, did you get a good whiff of the smell?
I did get a good whiff of the smell.
My name's Phyllis Younger, and you go and get up in the morning, like we did this morning, to go do laundry. You walk out the door and it's like suffocating.
Younger says the odor emanates from the Green Earth Waste Recycling Plant. And not only is it unpleasant, but also unhealthy.
It's hard for me because I have COPD to breathe. I come out the door, I can't breathe. I have to do my inhalers to even get past it.
Her husband, Robert Younger, says the reek is nothing like he's ever experienced here or elsewhere.
It is just bad. I mean, I've been stationed overseas in the Far East, and I guarantee you this place outdoes the smells that we had over there. Rotten plants and open sewers and what have you. But this, on a scale of 1 to 10 compared to that stuff, this is about a 12.
Also nearby is a dump run by the company Waste Management. But Diana Ellis, a resident and the manager of the neighboring Phoenix Metro RV Park, says the overwhelming waft didn't show up until more recently when the recycling plant did.
I've lived in this two-block radius for the last 18 years, and never did I ever smell anything coming out of the Waste Management plant over there. But ever since this place has opened up, the smell, suffering with burning, hurting, itching eyes, sneezing.
Ellis says the RV parks hold about 200 vehicles, most of them seasonal, and that their wintertime clients aren't returning because of the putrid smell.
Who would expect that a recycling mulching plant would cause as many issues as it has? And my residents coming to me and saying, if something isn't done about that, we won't come back.
The complaints by local residents and businesses led to the city of Phoenix denying a 3-year use permit for Green Earth in July. But the plant operators submitted an appeal. Mike Espinosa is owner of the facility.
What we process is green waste. We deal with pine chips that come from Snowflake. We deal with the green waste that comes out of the valley. And it's strictly green waste.
Espinosa says his composted mulch is sold to the Scotts Company, which has certified it as safe, and that the plant is doing a service to the environment by removing mulch from landfills.
It's not like I'm saying, hey, give me your manure, or give me your food waste, because those are things that will rot and will create an odor. This is green waste. These are pine chips. These are pine cones and pine needles and things that don't necessarily have an odor.
He maintains that every local government agency that has investigated his plant has found nothing harmful.
You know, if you look at it, there's Waste Management, garbage. There's my company. There's all these other industrial companies. And then right plotted down in the middle of that, there's an RV park. So it doesn't look to me as if my company's out of place. It's a matter of fact, I didn't have anything to do with the zoning. The city did.
Again, resident Bob Younger.
We're full-time RVers, so, yeah, I could get up and move, but why should I? I was here before that place was. Everybody was here before that place was. To me, I think they're trying to force us out.
Meanwhile, mulching operations at the facility are continuing until another hearing on the matter September 3rd. That's when the city will decide whether to shut down the plant permanently or let it continue to operate. Phil Latsman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
there's music in the air. Can you see it?
A group of Valley musicians and composers is hoping you do. Their new event asks listeners to draw to music.
And not just because it's a Zen activity. The idea is to use colors, lines, and shapes to illustrate what you hear. The show's Anika Klein takes a look and a listen.
What do you see when you hear this? How about this? It may seem strange to draw something that's invisible, but the Phoenix nonprofit Oh My Ears is asking people to give it a try. It's a new event they're calling Musical Map Making. In this room at the Burton Barr Central Library, a few tables are topped with art supplies, big sheets of white paper, crayons, and markers. Michael Ferraro co-directs Oh My Ears along with Elizabeth Bayer.
This particular piece that we're going to hear, it's called Daughter of the Waves. You're going to hear the flute, which is a higher pitched instrument that you blow into to make a sound, the clarinet.
That's Bayer introducing one of the songs the participants will hear. She lists the French horn, trumpet, electric guitar, violin, viola, and cello. A lot of instruments to pick apart in just one piece. Now the drawing begins. Everyone has their own interpretation. It's almost like a conversation. The music says something, and the listener responds on the paper. Michael Ferraro suggests considering how the music makes you feel.
Does this make you think of cool colors, this part? Does it make you feel warm colors? Does it make you feel like using real big, like aggressive strokes? Are you doing small stuff?
This exercise is often used in youth music education, says Dr. Alex Ruthman, director of the New York University Music Experience and Design Lab.
One thing that drawing along and imagery does is it gives you a reference point to have a conversation about what somebody might be hearing or paying attention to or listening to.
Ruthman says the differences in the drawings help students compare elements of a song. He often has students re-listen to songs while looking at their classmates' drawings.
It was then evident to the other kids. All of a sudden, they heard what that other kid heard. They're creating meaning through tracing and drawing and sharing with their friends.
It's kind of warm. Mm-hmm.
Sierra Collister is drawing with her three kids at Burton Barr. Their drawings of fish and robots might not be direct translations of the music, but Collister is satisfied.
They would have never sat for a half an hour listening to classical music without the art. And then the snacks helped as well.
The Oh My Ears event is a combination of music and art. And Michael Ferraro says he thinks it improves both experiences.
Something about it just allows people to kind of like be content with sitting there and like focusing on both the music and what they're drawing.
Oh My Ears has plans to bring live performers to future musical map-making events to create an interactive concert experience. And if you're curious how those musical maps turned out, you can navigate over to the show.kjzz.org. I'm Anika Klein.
Good afternoon. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the one-day $5 Thursday member drive, looking for a $5 a month or more sustaining gift from you as you support KJZZ and this community resource. The number to call is 888-774-9150 or go to kjzz.org.